So, you know, how we introduce our piece of work and how you introduce yourself and your goals and your personal goals and your relational goals with them is so important. And a lot of times we go straight into these pieces of work and we don't set up those clear kind of boundaries and information. And really what being trauma-informed is letting people know that this is my intention. This is what we're going to create together. And this is what I'm hoping you might get out of this. Now, part of that is saying, I'm a mandated reporter. I want you to feel safe and comfortable with anything that we address, but I have to tell you, if I hear anything that has to do with you being put at harm, putting other people at harm, or somebody having hurt you in a, you know, sexual, physical, emotionally abusive way, I do have to report it to a confidential help, in confidential line. That may hold them back from doing it, but you have to let them know. You have to let them know. Because if they, then you have to tell them that you have to report something. It's real relational trauma. So I always think, hey, you know what? It might hinder the relationship at the beginning a little bit, but it also lets them know that I will stick by my word. I'm reliable and that I will protect you. Even though you may not want that protection, I that's my job. That I'm going to hold down boundaries and that this is my purpose of doing this. And I think that the way we start work, sometimes we don't build that framework. And then we run into trust issues and we run into issues with not being able to get through or connect, because then we have to backpedal and then introduce something later. Did anybody else have anything?
I think from a social work perspective, you have to be really careful when using this, because you can do more harm than good, which is never our intent. And if you don't have the education or training to deal with a client, if they become triggered, then it could be really damaging. Also, within the two forms, I really like that the longer form has more variety in the scale, because often is a really hard term for youth to understand, because it could be often within a month or a year.
Yeah.
So when it says like many times, few times, that might be much easier for them to answer.
And I agree 100% with Jenny. I think that I think we have to speak to the people that are in the room, and most of us are in the employment and training and education business. And I think when we pull the scab, we're attempting to pull scab off issues, we're ill-equipped to deal with them. So, you know, like Jenny's, I think that's a good point. I think you really have to be, I don't know, by show of hands, how many clinicians do we have in this room? So I think it's very important that when we sit a young person down and we talk about things that are outside the scope of what they're there for, that you're really putting yourself in a situation from a liability standpoint that you're gonna do more damage then. So I guess for me, to get the value out of what we're doing, I would really like to drive it home to the folks in the room, what they're actually doing, and if this is a viable piece in terms of their actual work.
Yeah. And I think that's an important piece, right? Because somebody in your organization might say, hey, we want you to start using ACE scores with everybody. And you might have to say, hey, I've done the ACE. I know what it looks like. I've experienced it. I've been through training on it. I know that this will work with this client group, but not this client group. I know that if you want me to use the ACE as a statistical tool within our organization, you need to provide me with a counselor, social worker, somebody that can then facilitate whatever backlash comes out of this. And I think that this is part of being trauma-informed too, is thinking about these trauma tools that we use, and do they work for me? What scaffolding do I need? What support do I need to have if I'm going to use these in my organization? Do I want to use them? How might this be useful for one client versus another client? You know, and I think that that's a beautiful piece and a really important piece. And just to kind of talk a little bit to that, some people are starting to use this in doctor's practices. So doctors are not clinicians at all. And they're probably on some level, and this is gonna sound bad, but they're probably less empathetic and caring than a lot of you that are in this room in terms of the type of work that they do. So it's interesting, you know, to know that that's doing, that that's happening. And I'll explain why that's happening, because we're gonna get into what these scores actually are predict. It's not just a mental health. It's actually a public health and physical health. So especially when you have somebody that's coming in with a great deal of symptomology, headaches, stomach aches, physical problems, back problems, this might help explain some of that to them. So that's kind of where this other piece, and this is why a doctor or a physician would start using this with clients.
One of the things I'm feeling is that we've gone through the training in Onassis before at our place of work, but I've never administered them to any of the young people, young families that I've worked with. But the reality is, this opened my eyes to the level of trauma that they were experiencing, because I knew their stories anecdotally.
Yeah.
I, you know, we didn't do a test, but I knew who had family members in prison. I knew who was living without food every day. I knew who was struggling and all these different, maybe not every detail, but it really changed my perspective on how to respond to things, how to listen, how to talk with young people. The other thing I was going to say is that I do a program to teach young parents who want to breastfeed. So we actually did a class on the effects of alcohol and drug abuse and stress on your pregnancy and on your breastfeeding. And in the midst of that class, without any questions, without talking about background, one of the young dads, as we talked about all the effects of alcohol on an unborn fetus and how it's going to affect them, said, "That's what's wrong with me."
Yeah.
He just recognized this, you know, uncontrollable anger outburst, the inability to control his impulses. He recognized that as we were teaching in this very non-threatening issue about your coming baby, and he was struggling with his sobriety at that time, his own sobriety, but could see the effects of this on his life now as a young man, as an adult with children. And it really impacted him in a way, so that now he has been clean and sober for over a year. And so that was, it was not, there was no test, there was nobody identifying, hey, you are, you know, you're an adult child of alcoholics, you're this. He was able to, just in the course of expressing this information and giving it in a non-threatening way, he was able to access it for himself.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes what this, if you do decide to use it or you don't decide to use it, but what it does is it triggers that aha moment, that connection moment, that, you know what, actually it wasn't in my family, but everybody around me was doing it. And sometimes, you know, that's that, just that realization, just holding that in mind, especially as you move into a piece around psychoeducation and around the brain works and the way the trauma affects the brain, creates a good platform to be able to say, ah, okay, this is why I like will go off on somebody like this, and everybody else can do it, but I can't, you know. So it's an interesting piece, but those sometimes in safe environments, those pieces come out naturally too. And I think that that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that.
I was just gonna ask, like, in those moments where it's like, cause like I've run into a lot of just like run into a lot of different stories, and like for me, my thing is just like if we're creating these safe spaces. Like, let's say, for instance, yesterday I ran into a young man who just got out of prison like 5 years ago. He was in prison for 5 years and now he's out, you know? So to me, my initial thought is like, oh my God, get him connected. Like, you know, how do we create this type of place where it's like, if I'm connecting you to these resources, that they are going to be doing what, like taking that action and not just being about, oh, we're here to just hear your story and then we leave that bandage open and it's not really being healed. Like, you're not walking with me through that healing journey. Because I've seen a lot of that where it's just like, oh, you share your story and that's it. You see what I'm saying?
I think that's a really good point. We open up wounds and then we do nothing to be able to heal them. We pop a Band-Aid on them. And I think that that's a really important point, is that if you are to use any of these tools, that you really think about how you are going to then move forward with it. What is your purpose behind using this? Is it for them? Everything that you do should be for your client's benefit. So this is not a tool for me. This is why I tell people, you don't have to share it with me. this is not for me. This is to be aware of where we're coming at from in the piece of work that we do together, and to hopefully be a motivator to then try and prevent some of the things that come with high scores on the ACEs. Not that I don't want to make people, especially if I'm in one of these environments, it's a non-clinical environment, I don't want to make people tell their story. I think that by filling this out, they're aware. I don't need to know. They can tell me they got a 4. I don't need them to go into any personal narrative that I don't have the experience or the capacity to be able to handle. Because when you get into personal narrative is where you are going to have somebody that's continually telling all these different professionals their story. Wouldn't it be easier to say, I have an A score of 4? When you go into a clinical meeting with the next clinical or the next professional that's going to help you. I mean, it's a common language. And I think that is the one nice thing about this, as you think about if somebody comes into you, not asking them, not having to re-enter, not having to reopen the wound and tell another person that you don't know your whole life story, to just say, I have an A score of 3. I have an A score of 4. It actually creates a common language between professionals that are providing services, and for that person to not have to continue to tell their story. If I know that somebody has a score of 4, I know where they're at in the risk category. I know that they've experienced one of those 10 things on the 10 questions, 4 of them, I don't need to know, unless I'm willing to go there, unless I think that's beneficial for them. But it does create something that's a little bit more distanced and a little bit more concrete, especially as we move people through our system. Especially if we know that they're gonna have to do multiple referrals. You can also tell them that. Like, you know, next time when I refer you to so-and-so service and they ask you about your life experience, you can tell them, I have an A score of 3. I have an A score of 4. Or you cannot. But it does create that ability, because I think we traumatize people by to making them tell their story and be vulnerable to people they don't know and don't trust over and over again. And then we have clinical paperwork that we pass on and referrals that we pass on that sometimes are a little biased. I would rather put on my clinical paperwork that I'm referring to, you know, an outreach service or something that's not a clinical service, a non-clinical service. This family, or, you know, this mother has an A score of 4. They have an A score of 2. If they want to know more detail and they build a relationship with my client, then that's cool. My client has 100% the ability to tell them. But I think that sometimes we ask for too much information and we pass along information that might be biased or might, you know, contain information that they don't want to share. Think about that average referral, and this is something clinicians are really guilty about. Have you guys ever gotten a referral from a clinician? The stuff they divulge in those referrals, I wouldn't want people knowing. Your clients never even get to see this stuff a lot of the time. How are we protecting their rights, their story, their narrative, their experience when we write their whole life story and give it to another professional without their permission? How are we respecting? We're not. So I think that, you know, one of the hopes from this, especially as, you know, doctors and educators use this, is to say, you know, hey, my client has an A score of 3 or 4 or whatever it may be, and they pass it along without giving that family or that person's whole personal history that they probably have never even seen. If we were to read back what we write about the clients, how would they feel about it? And you know, from a clinician point of view, I don't think they'd want to see that. I don't know if I'd want to read what a clinician had wrote about me and then passed to somebody else to help me. If I didn't, you know, it's become a culture of passing along narratives and things without people's permission. And I think that that's, you know, something we also want to avoid. We do it with confidentiality. We ask permission to make a referral. But what we write in that can be very biased. So go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying.
At what age is it appropriate to give?
You can give it to anybody. It just depends. I mean, a lot of times I think that if you have somebody younger, I would probably, you know, do it with the parents. And, you know, you can have the parents fill it out. The parents, you know, a lot of stuff is intergenerational. So if they look at it and they say, no, I don't want you to ask my child that, which is fine. So, you know, would you be open to filling it out? So I think that that's another piece. I would always, there are going to be parents that know that this is going on in their house that are not going to want you to fill it out with their kid. And you know, we have to respect that. Because it brings up stuff. Especially if they know that it's going on in the house. So that's a good point. Thank you. So it is 10:30. We're going to take a 10-minute break if that works for everybody. And then we'll come back and I'm going to show you a video about the ACEs. We're going to go into detail about what the ACEs scores mean, how they relate to bigger health issues. And so that way we have some more knowledge about that. I normally bring my really good sound bell, and I just realized I brought the mic that doesn't have like the really good energy cleaning bell in it, so I don't know if I like this one. It's kind of like bike bell, but not as good. So I'm going to stand up for a little bit as I talk about this too. So back to the ACES, everybody's probably wondering, why would I want to give this horrible test to anybody that I'm working with in this way? But the ACES is actually came out of a kind of collaboration through Kaiser Permanente, their Department of Preventative Medicine, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. So ACES stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and it tries to account for the traumatic experiences that can have an impact on the child's developing brain and body with lasting impacts through a person's health and livelihood through their lifetime. There is a video link on here. I'm going to show you some other videos that kind of sum it up, and you can decide kind of what you like. So if you were introducing this to a client, to a group that you're working with, to other professionals, you have some things that kind of explain it in a nutshell, also kind of giving some reasoning behind it, so that you don't get caught up and when they see it, they're like, eh. It kind of explains like, why you'd want to do it. I'll also show you a video of some older kind of young adults, teenagers, talking about what they got from their ACE scores and how they're using their ACE scores. So that way you can see it from that perspective as well. Because it does feel intrusive, and that's why I have you do it yourself, because you can kind of experience it. But azpbskit.org Strong Kids has a kind of little blurb from Dr. Folletti, who's one of the people that did the primary researching on this, to talk about it as well. So, again, it's from the Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies. So I'm gonna show you a few kind of short videos just to kind of introduce you to tools that you can use when you're introducing this. I think that, you know, one of the challenges is that if you're not a clinician, how do I introduce a tool that has kind of clinical, might bring up clinical material? What do I do with this? How do I present this to people? How do I sell people on even wanting to do this? Because they may not want to do this. It's important, right? And, you know, sometimes somebody else's explanation words are better than the way that we might kind of stumble through it, especially if we don't feel 100% confident using it. So I think that that's a key thing, too. So I'm just going to tap into my videos here. And I forget, how do I get the screen moving? How do I move on that screen?
Oh, to play. All the way to the right side of the map.
Okay.
Off the right side of the screen.
Oh, sorry. Wrong right.
Can everybody see that?
What does your parents' divorce have to do with your risk for heart disease? If your mother had a drinking problem when you were growing up, are you more likely to suffer from depression as an adult? Here's what you should know about ACEs. ACEs stand for Adverse Childhood Experiences, extremely stressful events that can happen to a child growing up. Some experiences are so stressful that they can alter brain development, as well as the immune system, increasing the risk of lifelong health and social problems in adulthood. The term comes from the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, landmark research that shed new light on the root cause of everything from stroke and liver disease to substance abuse and mental illness. In the late 1990s, an epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and a preventive medicine doctor at Kaiser Permanente set out to understand the association between childhood experience and lifelong health. They asked over 17,000 people in the Kaiser Health Plan in San Diego about their health history, as well as difficult questions about their experiences growing up. Thank you. Amanda and Felitti tallied up 10 different kinds of adversity in this largely middle class and college educated population. They were stunned to see how common ACEs were. 21% of all respondents were sexually abused as children. 19% grew up with someone who suffered mental illness. 28% had been physically abused. And 2 out of 3 respondents had experienced at least one ACE. The researchers next looked at how someone's ACE score, or the number of adversities they experienced, related to a wide array of serious health and social problems. They saw that the more ACEs someone had, the greater their risk for poor outcomes compared with someone with no ACEs. Someone with an ACE score of 4 had twice the risk of heart disease and cancer. Someone with an ACE score of 5 had an 8 times greater chance of being an alcoholic. And those with an ACE score of 6 or more, on average, died 20 years earlier. With every major problem they looked at in the ACE study, the risk went up for each additional adverse experience in childhood. As Dr. Robert Anda says, what's predictable is preventable. It's important to remember that ACEs are not destiny. ACEs are a tool for understanding the health of a population as a whole. For individuals, an ACE score can be a tool for understanding their own risk for health and social problems, and empower them to make changes for themselves and their children. ACEs tend to get passed down from generation to generation and are common across all income levels, races, and cultures. But increasingly, people of all different professions and backgrounds are coming together to discuss how ACEs affect their communities. They're finding new ways to treat and prevent ACEs. Many doctors are starting to screen their patients for ACEs as part of their medical history. More schools are becoming trauma-informed, considering the source of problem behavior when disciplining their students instead of immediately suspending or expelling them. To learn more about interrupting the cycle of adversity and improving health and well-being for the next generation, please visit kpjrfilms.co.
So that's kind of like a little kind of short, brief introduction to understanding it. And, you know, I think that we raised an important point about, you know, how do I use this and whether I want to use this. But I think that you're going to find that there's going to be a shift as, and I know that the governor's approving some work around companies, organizations, providers becoming trauma-informed. So I think that this is really trying to give you an understanding of, even if you don't use it, that other people will be using it. You might get it on your referral paperwork. You might understand it from other people that are referring people to you, and they might refer to ACE scores. So it's making you aware of, you know, that this is going to be something that's coming and that it's going to be more widely spread and it's going to be talked about. And I think that, you know, the more we speak a common language about it, the better. But I think that it should always, and the key part that I take from the video is that it always should be used as a way of thinking about empowerment. So how do we, knowing that we have this risk, what are we going to do to help you not have these effects, and to also not pass these effects down to your children? And I think that's kind of the way that I look at it. And I think that the more we're in denial about where we come from and what we've experienced, the greater risk we are of having the negative side effects of that. And so, unfortunately, some things have become taboo in terms of what we talk about, but they're big risk factors, and they're big health risk factors. So I think that's the important piece, you know, as you think about whether you want to use this or not, or just, you know, how you find out more about it and who you want to use it with, I think is an important piece too. So that's kind of one video on it. And then I'm going to kind of walk you through some of the statistics here. I'm just turning it back on. How do I get back on the presentation? How do I get the mouse back on there? I'm really good with technology. Okay, cool. All right, so this is kind of some of the statistics that they found. And other populations. So when we looked at the initial study, they talked about the 18,000 people that they interviewed were a very affluent kind of white middle class population in San Diego. And those were the results that you saw there in terms of the statistics on them. These are the statistics on a more realistic population of what you might be working with. And in these ones, you see 40% of the children have experienced four or more. So there's a much higher population percentage of these. And the statistics go up. So you'll see other kind of other things that you might not even thought about that are on here in terms of the original ACE study and additional studies into trauma, where we're looking at other kind of events such as extreme interpersonal violence, kidnapping, forced displacement, war, a lot of our populations that are coming in, you know, as migrant and immigrant populations have experienced war, terrorism, political violence. And so those rates are also kind of growing. Forced displacement, I mean, that's something we never talked about. Like, what happens when we keep moving kids, you know, through the system, through different, you know, carers, through different, you know, situations? That's forced displacement. That's displacing against will. And a lot of times it is against will, you know, so these are important things to keep in mind. I think that, you know, you probably would not have seen school violence on here in the past. The fact that we have, you know, that amount of people that are experiencing school violence now, we're talking about serious school violence and, you know, the prevalence of that. So those go beyond just the original ones that, you know, that are on that form. And they're just something to be aware of when we're looking at trauma, and these are the additional traumas that people are experiencing. And they're high, you know, these are high. So it's something to keep in mind as we look at that too. So, and when you look at the ACEs, there's two kind of categories, and one of them is abuse and neglect. So that's kind of recurrent physical abuse, recurrent emotional abuse, sexual abuse, emotional or physical neglect. Now, the questions kind of speak to this, but people may not know what this looks like. Somebody might not know what emotional or physical neglect looks like. You may need to define these terms or give examples or provide information about this. Because they know they experienced something. They know that nobody smiled at them, like they loved them and thought they were wonderful, but they don't know that that's actually neglect in a way. The other category is household dysfunction. So that's the alcohol or drug abuser, incarcerated household family member, someone chronically depressed, suicidal, institutionalized, mentally ill. They put mother being treated violently, but I think that, you know, hopefully this will change, because I don't know, you know, I think this is a very kind of an old-fashioned way to refer to this, because I think that I've had at least a lot of clients where there's been physical abuse between both members of the family, siblings, you know, other people in the community. So I think that's kind of an old-fashioned way of looking at it. They'll probably do that. And one or no parents. Now, again, this one or no parents, you know, is, if we're looking at the community structure of raising children, that's not as relevant for me. You know, if they had a wonderful grandmother or a wonderful, you know, uncle or somebody else that was providing care for them and the parents weren't there, it may not have the same level of effect. It's more having a significant caregiver.
But I think having the absence of a real parent would also make it.
Because, you know, you have to think about how that plays psychologically. Mm-hmm. How that plays psychologically, you know, if I think that, you know, I was doing a trauma timeline with a little girl yesterday. And we are looking at it, And she was talking about, you know, we were talking about mom, and she's like, you know, mom was not there. And I said, okay, well, you know, she lived with the grandmother, and, you know, the grandmother was a caregiver, and unfortunately the grandmother was abusive, but she said that mom would come in and out. And I said, well, you know, what did that look like for you? And she said, well, mom would sometimes show up, and mom would sometimes wouldn't. And we remember, and this is at like 3 or 4 years old, waiting for mom at Peter Piper Pizza, and mom not showing up. And us not feeling important enough for mom to show up. And that mom sometimes would show up, but mom would sit on her phone the whole time talking to somebody else. So I think that, you know, technically we would say that, okay, mom maybe was there, but she wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And you could say that mom wasn't there. So, you know, like, it's an interesting kind of interpretation depending on the way that your client looks at it, mm-hmm. as to whether somebody was present, not present, whether, you know, how mm-hmm. that, what that mm-hmm. looks like.
This might be a difficult question, so I'll try not to muddle too much through it. So how does this impact a situation where you have, say, a youth who is in that scenario where they're living with a grandmother or an aunt and uncle, and that person is going out of their way to create such a healthy environment that the kid just looks at it as, this is normal, this is my life, I have an individual who's cared about me, all the boxes are checked. But then later life, everything kicks in when they realize, wait a second, my mom was never around, or, you know, when she was around, you know, she was being managed by, you know, maybe grandma or something like that, or like not engaged. That person really doesn't even necessarily see that person as a parent, but more or less like, I don't know, a relative or something. Like,
yeah.
I guess how does that addressed when, say, the youth hits that maybe at 10, everything's all good. You know, they fill out the ACEs, they're going like, hey, you know, yeah, I live with my uncle, but everything's good. And then they're like, say, 18 or say 17, and that's when they realize, wait a second, it was all messed up, or this, my actual mom didn't care, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Hope that was kind of clear.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point, and I think that that what happens is that the way that the questions are worded is that, did this ever happen to you? So it depends how early that person was taken, you know, taken into the house. A lot of kids that, you know, are adopted early or go into other family settings early may or may not remember this. So this would be an important thing where I would say, you know, like, if you know that that's a history, that I would have them complete it with somebody else in their family. It sucks to have to go back and look at the fact that actually your first 3 years were terrible and you don't remember them, but actually they were. But they are a good indicator to prevent risk and to be able to think about that. It also is a beautiful way to show them sometimes how their brain was able to rebound. Like, look at, man, you're going to college. Like, yeah, you know what? This early stuff happened. You're just finding out about it. But you bounced back. You showed how the brain can be rewired. And these are all the things that could have happened, but they didn't because you were given this. And I think that that's a difficult piece, but I think that it's important to know that, because sometimes what we have is that when people find out about these things, or they become aware of them, or if they've never been worked through from a physical point of view, what you see is a lot of addiction. You see a lot of personalities that will get into a stressful situation at that point, will not have worked through the physical trauma of what's going on, and you'll see, you know, especially in college, you know, a lot of the substance use and the kind of risky sexualized behavior and stuff like that, as you get into older, you know, early adulthood, you know, and you see a lot of that, and they're like, why? And then they go back and look at this and they say, ah, I remember, this is what my life was like early on. It could be, though, that some of them have had enough good experiences to rewire in a positive way, and it doesn't matter. If you rewire and you're resilient, none of this matters. It's just to show you that, you know, these are the things that you're at risk for. If I know I have a huge risk for cancer in my family, it might defer me from smoking. If I know I am at risk for being an alcoholic because my parents were alcoholics, it might defer me from going out and binge drinking. It might not. But when you know that you have a risk for something, you have a greater choice and a greater insight into just feeling like there's something wrong with you, that actually I'm predisposed for this, so I might want to make choices that help prevent me from going down this route. You might not, but it's really just kind of information. And I think that, you know, when we talk about being preventative, that's what this is really about. It's not that we can erase the past. We can't go back and change the past. We can't go back and change their early experiences. This is not about going and reprocessing early experiences. We're not asking you to act as clinicians. What we're asking you to do is to be aware of risk factors and helping them make better decisions and provide avenues for them to be more resilient, to be able to avoid some of the risks that they might be, or the things that they might be at risk for. And some of these are social functioning issues. I think we all are kind of aware that, you know, certain things are passed down within families, but the health issues that come from this are huge. And I think that, you know, that idea of I could die 20 years younger, you know, that's huge. Beyond the heart disease and, you know, the other things that we're looking at. I think a lot of people now, there's enough kind of common knowledge within, you know, the fields and pop culture that certain things are passed down. But other things, you know, people just, they don't have any idea about the links between things and bigger health issues that are body-based. Sorry, did you want to? No. So, the three categories that I kind of mentioned, these are the kind of statistics that they have in terms of abuse. Abuse, we still see a higher rate of physical abuse on the ACEs scores, but you can see sexual abuse is really high. I mean, when you look at that, that might be surprising or not surprising to you, depending on what population you work on, but those are household challenges. Emotional abuse, I still feel is like under-identified. Because if you're gonna be physically abused and sexually abused, there's usually some type of emotional abuse going on. But people don't kind of maybe identify with it as much. I think you might see that as people become more emotionally aware. Household challenges, huge for substance abuse, but just as big as separation, divorce. I think we're kind of more aware of that statistic there. But substance abuse is high. And we're not just talking about, you know, what it used to be, where it was, you know, drugs, like real drugs. We're talking about prescription drugs. So I think that the prescription drug epidemic is huge. And it's relatively unseen. It's not seen in the same way because it's not seen as a street drug. And it comes from the doctor. But I think that that's probably going to continue to rise as we see more people addicted to painkillers and using those as an alternative.
Is there any correlation or a reason why, because sometimes I've seen or I've read other articles about, because separation and divorce is a very high percentage, but sometimes your parents staying together, even though they don't, there's no love, there might not be any physical or emotional violence, but sometimes them staying together is like more traumatizing than them probably separating in most cases, but there's never a statistic for that in particular.
No, and I think that's a really good point. Like I said, the fact that they put mother and not, you know, any partner or family member, you know, there's some things that on here that aren't reflective of, you know, what we actually see. I think, you know, I was married before I left a domestic violence situation. I know that separation and divorce was the right thing for my children. Will they have an ACE score that has that on there?
Yeah.
Yes, they will. But, and I know that it was also difficult. I know it was also difficult when we had to leave and, you know, going through that experience. So no matter how good the separation and divorce goes, it's still a separation and divorce, and that the unit that the children looked at as the, you know, the couple unit, whether it's married or unmarried or same sex or whatever it may be, is still the unit. And when any unit splits up and you have to go to two different houses and you have to hear, even if your parents are the best parents in the world and they never talk about each other or never say anything negative, it's still having a split life. And anytime you have to split your life, it's difficult. So 100%, I think that in a lot of situations, when people leave bad relationships,
It's actually a protective mechanism, but it also comes with the cost benefit, the cost of that child seeing a split between two people that were supposed to be the safe, connected people. And so I think that's why it's still on there. And it probably will stay on there for that reason. And that, you know, that's not to say that in many situations it's the best possible choice. But I think it's something to keep in mind. Incarcerated household member, I don't know if any of you work with populations where they've had a lot of parents that have gone to prison or been in and out of prison. Oh, really does a job on the children. It is really, really difficult for them. I have a lot of kids whose parents have been in and out of prison, and it's really confusing, especially when they're younger, trying to make sense of that. Even if it was for a time when they were real young and then they get out, it still is part of the family history, the narrative, and it still is, you know, challenging to work with. And again, we could look at that from the other point of view as like, hey, it's good this person's in jail because they should be in jail and they shouldn't have access to this child. But there's still the narrative that kid creates around the person that's in jail, and that the community creates around that person that's in jail too. And then neglect. So we have neglect. We're actually seeing more on the emotional neglect than the physical neglect on here. But I don't know if people always understand what physical and emotional neglect is. So I think that those are things that we'll probably grab. So the original ACEs study, this is the original data, and then the four or more is kind of what we really look at. Not that the other ones are not important, but the four or more is actually the yellow. And we can see that the yellow has gone up. Good thing is that the zero has also gone up. So concerning that the yellow has gone up and that there are more four or more, but there are also more people with zero. The other areas have kind of stayed relatively the same. So again, we're maybe seeing a reflection of all or none, which happens in other areas too. So if we look at the lasting effects of the ACEs, this is kind of where we see the behaviors. Behaviors are probably going to be the biggest thing that you can kind of appeal to because they're more concrete. Like, how do we get you out of this risk section for smoking, alcoholism, drug use. But I think that the other ones are equally important, and then especially the life potential, graduation rates, academic achievement, lost time from work, as well as the health issues that people may not have ever correlated with trauma. Obesity, diabetes, depression, suicide attempts, STDs, heart disease, cancer, stroke, COPD, and broken bones. So those are all big. They're really big. And this is kind of the way that they look at the ACE study and how it goes up through, and generally adverse childhood experiences, how they go up through the pyramid. Is that we have a choice at any of these points to intercept and be preventative and build resilience and all these beautiful things that we want to. But if we don't intervene, if we don't get to the core of this, this is the path that we eventually lead up to. And so I think that when you show this to somebody, okay, and they're really upset about it, you say, okay, well, this is where we could be. And then this is where do you want to be? We can stop here. We can cut this off. You don't have to go to the top of the pyramid. You are not doomed. You have an opportunity to reverse. You can't change the past, but you have an opportunity to not go up to the top of the pyramid. So there's a big connection between the childhood experiences and the community environments. So the biggest connectors that they're finding between, and this is a relatively new study, is that these are the biggest things that are connected in terms of community environments. And like when you look at the image of the tree, you think about where the roots are coming from. What's the soil like? How often are we getting watered in our community? And you see poverty, discrimination, community disruption, lack of opportunity, including economic mobility and social capital. So that's the ability to move up. That's the ability to move up within your community, and to make money, to move up academically, to make money, to be able to kind of get out of the neighborhood, if you choose that you want to do that. And then the community environments of poor housing quality and affordability, and then also violence. And they have been able to prove a connection between those roots and how it connects to the rest of the parts of the ACEs studies. So this is the people with four or more ACEs, and this is the increased risk rate. So it's profound. And some of these are things you wouldn't think. Loss of vision, 400%. And you know, like, you're like, this doesn't make any sense, but we're talking about a huge population study that's now, this has been done on. And so these are real. And this is with no, obviously with no intervention and no kind of work around resilience or building skills or, you know, this is just if you let the path go the way that the path is going instead of changing the path. But it's pretty profound. And, you know, the fact that we have heart attack, I think for me, heart attack makes sense. You know, your body's constantly dysregulated, you're in threat all the time, heart attack makes sense. But the things like loss of vision and, you know, all these other things, the COPD and the other stuff on there is pretty high. Suicide to me also makes sense, but yeah, it's huge, huge. So why is it important for somebody to know that they have a four? Why is it important for us to know? Because look at how much more risk they're at. We need to help these people. We need to support them in healing and growing and building resilience because this is what we're working with. They need us, right? I don't want to see half of my community get these things, be, you know, at this risk. And they might just have helped four or more ACEs because of living in my community, not because anybody's done anything wrong. But we want to help them. We want to be able to prevent some of this stuff. And, you know, the saddest thing is that our services come in at the end. So we got all, you know, we're starting to build more health treatments and, you know, centers in inner city communities. But that's the end. I don't want to get them once they've already got cancer. I want to help them not get cancer. You know, like, I want to help reduce these stats before they get to the point where they need to be serviced through medicine. And I think that's why it's important to doctors. And it's very interesting. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the other kind of health systems in other countries, but if you live in a public health system where the government's paying for health, where do you think the focus is on?
Prevention.
Prevention. Everything's about prevention. Because they don't want to pay for you to get sick.
Yeah, it's a lot less expensive to prevent and be healthy than it is for them.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that the shift to preventative medicine, I mean, we have a very expensive healthcare system, and the shift is all about treatment once you hit these stats, not about preventative care. And you guys have an opportunity to come in at a key point in terms of preventative medicine, in terms of preventative growth, in terms of trying to reduce these statistics. And that's really exciting. It's exciting for people to also know they're not doomed. Yeah, like, hey, this is where you could go, but hey, let's get motivated. Let's work on this. Let's not be there. Here's some more stats on this. You got 2 times as likely to smoke, 7 times as likely to be alcoholics, 6 times as likely to have sex before age 15, 2 times as likely to have cancer or heart disease, 12 times more likely to have attempted suicide. People with, these are just 4 or more. 6 or more, 46 times more likely to have injected drugs. 90% of chronic health issues. So if we go back and we do this at the end, where we have these people that are coming into our clinics with medical problems, what do we see? Well, we see that 90% of them have a score of 4 or more. And 90% of people having mental health services or needing mental health intervention also have a score of 4 or more. So that's the population you're servicing. If you did this and you had a score of 4 or more, well done you. somebody at some point came into your life and did something awesome to get you to the point that you are here. So, you know, be proud of yourself. And, you know, when we go into the second piece where we're thinking about how we impact people, I really want you to reflect on who's impacted you. How did you not go this way? How are you in this room right now opposed to going the opposite way, which is where, you know, a lot of people go. So I think that's an important piece too, because you can use that to then work with the people that you're working with. Now you know what your score is. You can use that. You can use that with them. You can even share it with them if you want to. I think the more real you are with people, if your score is super high and you graduated college or you got a good job or you're happy with your family and you've prevented some of these things or you don't smoke or, you know, whatever it may be, you can share that. You can say, you know what, hey, I scored 6 and I'm here with you, you know, and that's a big deal.
What if you never really had anybody? I mean, there's certain people, like maybe a teacher told you, you know, you're smart or something, but there was never really somebody like pretty significant that was there always telling you like, you're gonna get out of this. Because I remember growing up, you know, I wasn't expected to like graduate from high school or go to college or anything like this. And you know, my mom always wanted the best for me, but it wasn't like, we never really had a close relationship. My stepfather and I never really got along. He was never really a fatherly figure, even though he was my stepfather. And I scored a 7. And I just don't understand how I was as resilient all by myself without really knowing that I was at risk for all these things growing up until basically recently.
Wait till we go into the stuff in resiliency, and I want you to think about, as we talk about it, what things. It doesn't always have to be the other person.
Because I always remember that I would always, the thing that I always remember that I would tell myself is like, I would use the negative stuff and say, I'm not ever going to end up like this. And
that statement played over and over and over and over and over will have the same resiliency effect.
But I think that's a shining example of the impact of what we're attempting to do. I mean, this young lady is at a point where emotionally she's reaching out. And, you know, I just think we need to speak to that.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be in situations with kids.
Yeah.
Where that comes up, so.
Yeah.
So how do we?
I think that's really important.
So how do we speak to her issue right now?
In so far as.
Well, I don't think.
Like, how did you feel? Yeah.
I've never tried drugs. I think that emotionally, it helped me being spiritual in my relationship with God.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's obviously everybody's different, and they have different, you know, religious views. But I think that's probably, that's in the combination of me saying I'm not going to end up like this, or I'm not going to be another statistic type of thing is what carried through. But I still don't understand how, because it seems like we're using this, and now we're using this to help students and say, you know, you're at risk for these factors, you know, because of what you've gone through. So let's work on something so you can get out of it. But I was never told these things, and I was never.
You found them. And when we talk about resiliency, you'll see that two of the biggest resiliency factors are faith and spirituality, whatever it may be. And this is if you don't, sometimes it's one person. Sometimes it's faith and spirituality. Sometimes it's positive thinking. And mantras and using those kind of positive thinking statements. Sometimes it's turning the negative into a positive. But when you combine several of these resiliency techniques, strategies, whatever, that's when you get resiliency. So you didn't even know, nobody told you. But luckily you had that, something was modeled at you for some point to connect with God, to go to church, even though you weren't able to connect with the parents, to do that. And so therefore, that is a protective factor.